Hello and welcome to the Android Central podcast. My name is Daniel Bader. We are recording this only a couple of hours after Google's launch night in event on Wednesday, September 30th, 2020. So we are going to dive right in, and we have three amazing, intelligent people to help us figure it all out. Joining us, Hayato Huseman. What's going on? How are you?
Not too bad. It's been a couple of episodes.
Yeah, you've been busy.
I have.
We've been trying to chase you down, but glad you're here. Also here with us, Ara Wagner. Welcome back. How are you?
I am good. Very happy to be here. It's been a while.
You have a lot of things to say about the announcements today, so I'm excited to hear them. And rounding us up is Joe Maring, who is also, right after this, going to head to a Target to pick up his Chromecast with Google TV. So he'll be the one doing the review. So let's dive right in, because we got a lot to get through. We will start with Pixels. This was not a surprise. Nothing announced today was actually a surprise, except for a couple of the software improvements. But let's talk about the Pixels. We have two Pixels, the Pixel 5, Pixel 4a, 5G. Ara, start us off. Anything catch your eye about these two devices? Walk us through what your kind of early impression is of this duo and how it compares to Google's previous phone releases.
The obvious thing for the Google Pixel 5 is it's not even trying to go for the $1,000 category, $800, $900 category the way it did last year, which I'm very, very thankful for, because I don't really think that last year's Pixel was worth $800, $900. And the Pixel 5 looks like it actually justifies its price tag, because we still get a 90 hertz display. We finally got a wide angle lens on a Pixel camera. Woohoo! And we got 5G, and we've got the IP68 rating, and we've got wireless charging that should finally be regular and not weird and glitchy in any way the way it has been for the last 2 years. So happy to have a Pixel that'll finally wireless charge at top speed without feeling like it's pulling teeth. And of course, we also have the colors. I mean, the orange last year with the Pixel 4 and the Pixel 4 XL was okay. I mean, I'm a pumpkin lover. I'm a pumpkin seed lover. So anything Halloweenish is a cool color. But this green color for the Pixel 5 is darling, and I need cases in that color immediately.
Darling. So it's sage green. This is a new, I guess we could have seen the writing on the wall from the mint Pixel Buds that were announced last year, but green does seem to be Google's color going into at the end of 2020.
Well, also the mint is just a very different shade of green compared to the sage green. Like, the mint reminded me more of like the purplish Pixel 3a and the mint Stadia controller that they had.
Yeah, I guess that's fair. I don't really, I'm looking at my Stadia controller. I have the blue one with orange highlights. I feel like it's interesting, right? Like, Google always does something with colors, and this one sort of sage is cute. It feels earthy in a way that a few Google products, a few Google phones, I guess, have in the last couple of years. This is definitely a year where feeling a little bit more close to nature is a nice thing when everybody is stressed all the time, and potentially having a phone in your hand that calms you down is not a bad thing.
It's and soothing. It's a nice green tea color.
If you're not going to cover it with a case, but you know, most people are going to do that anyway.
Well, that's what clear cases are for.
I mean, I'm just very here for this new trend of, I guess, everybody this year of doing these like pastel-y kind of soft colors. I'm a big fan of turquoise and teal and sage, and just give me more of that in everything, really.
Yeah, phone colors do not need to slap you in the face with how bold they are. Although I will say the cloud red for that Galaxy S20 FE is looking nice.
Yeah, the green looks good, but I will say I had a lot of love for like the offensively deep blue from the first Pixel and the orange on Pixel 4. Like, those are really nice colors, but it is interesting to get like a very different like aesthetic, I guess, from these new phones. Like, I'm all for Google trying new styles and seeing what works for them.
Oh yeah, no, that's totally blue though, for the... Yes.
It slapped you in the face. It was so loud. I couldn't deal with it.
But it was so pretty. It was like looking into the ocean on a perfectly clear day.
I hope your ocean doesn't look like the Pixel 1 did.
Yeah, that looks like radioactive ocean. I don't know, maybe where you live, but not where I want to go. That's not a holiday destination. That's more like, you know, outside of Chernobyl, where people go to take photos of like bright green water because it's good for Instagram. I don't want anything to do with that. So obviously the Pixel 5, we have the black version, we have the sort of sage version. None of the hardware specs were a surprise. This thing leaked months ago. Those leaks were reinforced and then reinforced again. And finally today, with the launch, we just have exactly what we expected, which is good, right? I think the $699 price is something people are going to be quite happy with. I don't think anybody's going to complain that this phone is too expensive. It's interesting that Samsung announced the Galaxy S20 FE last week at the same price. This does seem to be where the mid-range is settling right now, or as Hayato, you put it, the premium mid-range or the budget flagship or whatever you want to call it. But it does feel like this is a, you know, we have the super premium Galaxy Note 20 Ultra, Galaxy Z Fold 2, iPhone 12 Pro Max, whatever. They'll all be $1,300, $1,400. And now at $700, you're getting a really good value phone without a lot of compromises. And let's actually talk about what you aren't getting with this phone, because I feel like the compromises Google made, especially after hearing them explain the reasonings, makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, I think really all the only feature you're really losing, I guess, is the 865 Plus, or just having whichever processor you might want. This is going to have the 765G in it. So it's nothing crazy high-end, but it should be plenty for basically everything the Pixel does, right? I mean, like, the Pixel has never really been about having the top-end specs or anything. I'm really looking forward to the fact that this is going to be the first Pixel phone that I think I've ever used with a reasonably sized battery. It's like 4,080 milliamps. As far as things you're losing, I mean, it's the processor. You're maybe not getting the most RAM. It's only 6 gigabytes, but
8 gigs. 8 gigs. 8 gigs on the 5. Yeah.
Yeah, it's 6 on the 4A 5G and the 4A, which 6 feels like enough, honestly.
I think so. I mean, I guess the only things you're losing from last year's phones, there's no more Soli, which means no more face unlock. No more of the motion sense if you really use that, which I think, you know, maybe tens of people will be disappointed about the loss of that.
I liked it, but I agree. Not a lot of people bought the phone anyway to appreciate it.
I mean, I loved the face unlock itself, but the gestures were just not at all my thing. They just, it went off on accident too often for me. And I guess the only other thing, you're losing the edge sense, the squeezing
active
function.
Active edge, yeah.
Active edge.
I activated that way too often, taking cases on and off of my phone.
Yeah, it's one of the first things I turned off on the Pixel 4, so I'm not too upset about it.
Yeah, especially with like the S20 FE Fan Edition comparison. Like I'm sure people on Twitter are going to take to it and be like, oh, well, Samsung's phone is the same price and you're getting the 865 Plus or 865, so it's like automatically the better deal. But like, as I used the Motorola Edge earlier this year, which is 765 and I think 8 gigs of RAM in that. And like for like the way I use my phone for like Slack, Twitter, a few light games here and there, like as far as I can tell, it feels just as snappy as an 865 would. And when you combine that with like a 90 hertz screen, which already gives you some added smoothness there, like I don't think most people will notice like a performance drop or be left out by not having like that slightly extra that added horsepower if they went with the 865.
Well, I mean, let's be real. How many people actually need a flagship smartphone in their lives in 2020? Like, we've hit the point where mid-range is, so long as you have a good camera and you have enough power to where it's not going to glitch up the second you try to swap between 3 or 4 apps simultaneously.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, even like the 730 in the regular Pixel 4a, like I use that as one of my daily phones and it like it does everything I want it to. It's a 60 hertz screen and a lower spec processor, but like it feels good to use. Like it's responsive. It runs the apps. Like you don't need an 800 series Snapdragon processor to have a phone these days, which is awesome.
Yeah, no, I haven't looked at my Galaxy S20 since the moment the Pixel 4a came in.
Well, that's interesting to know. I'm gonna have to get Jerry that phone now. He's gonna force me to send it. He's gonna force you to send it to him.
I'm sorry. I'll also include a mountain of cases with it because nothing will make him sadder.
Oh yeah, that's exactly what we want. We want Jerry swearing at us in our Slack channel because you sent him a mountain of cases that fell on his head.
Wait, are you being sarcastic? Because I really do want that.
Actually, yeah, that would be entertaining.
But we would need to set up a camera and make him unbox all of them.
So Terry is on board. I'm 99% sure she would be on board with that. So let's do it. All right, I want to talk about this. So as we're talking, all the press that Google did in the run up and at right before the launch is coming out, and one thing that Rick Osterloh said to the BBC is, "What the world doesn't seem like it needs right now is another $1,000 phone." Obviously, no one anticipated the pandemic, but we actually did think that the world was possibly headed for an economic downturn, and it only further emphasized our point of view that this is the right thing. So, obviously, in hindsight, that is great messaging for Google, and who knows how accurate that is, right? If Google finalized this hardware months ago, presumably more than 8 months ago before the pandemic hit, this is a convenient narrative that Google can use. But Osterloh is not wrong, right? Phones are expensive. It's clear that the Pixel 4a is good enough for most people, and the Pixel 4a 5G and Pixel 5. So I think we'll talk about the 4a 5G in a sec, but that feels like it's a concession to carriers who just wanted a 5G Pixel, right? It wasn't so much that Google wanted to make a 5G Pixel 4a, and we have it on good evidence that the Pixel 5 was originally going to be called the Pixel 5S, and the Pixel 4a 5G was going to be called the Pixel 5. So those two devices have 5G, but then in a briefing I just had with Google, it was on the record so I could talk about it, the company admitted that it thought the Pixel 4a 5G had more in common with the 4A than the 5, and therefore changed the name. So all this to be said, right, it's pretty confusing, but Google at the end of the day has a lineup that doesn't go from 350 to 1300. It goes from 350 to 500 to 700. And I think that's a pretty good range of value. And most people who buy a Pixel know that it really isn't about the specs. This is a phone about experiences first. And the things that Google cut out, it says it can reproduce for the most part in software.
Yeah, the 4a 5G, like the branding isn't great, and it's kind of a confusing device to launch a new 4a model alongside a 5 when we had the first 4a come out in August. But I think the compromises they made to hit that $499 price are really smart, because like I'm kind of bummed it doesn't have wireless charging, but I have to imagine that's still kind of a niche thing that a lot of people aren't going to care too much about. You're getting the 765G, which gives you 5G for whatever that's worth, but you also get a little performance boost over the regular Pixel 4a. And then you get the ultra-wide camera, which is the exact same one that you get in the Pixel 5, which for a lot of people is probably one of the biggest upgrades compared to like the Pixel 4 or an older Pixel they're coming from. So like if you don't care about a 90 hertz screen or wireless charging, which a lot of people probably don't, like most average consumers are not going to think twice about losing those two features to get most of that Pixel 5 experience for $200 less. Weird branding or not, like it's a really interesting device, especially like when you see carrier deals and stuff, it's going to be really hard to ignore.
Do you guys think the decision to move over to an ultra wide lens instead of a telephoto, do you think that was made sort of after Mark Lavoie left Google, since he was kind of the head of the camera tech for the Pixel 4 and basically told us on stage that a telephoto was more useful for what they wanted to do?
In short, I think yes. I think that Mark Lavoie was he's a man about data, right? This is a guy who cares a lot about metadata. And from a consumer-facing feature perspective, a telephoto isn't that useful. But from a data perspective, a telephoto is much more useful than an ultra-wide, because you get depth data from it. You get a ton of, when you combine it with the accelerometer and the other sensors in a phone, you just get a better sense of how you use the phone. And the Google Super High Res mode doesn't need a telephoto, but it obviously benefits from that data. So my guess is that not only did Google get a ton of usable metadata from Pixel 4 users to improve super high res zoom on the Pixel 5 and the 4a series, but there was probably enough pushback from people who didn't actually want the telephoto and wanted an ultra wide that they're like, okay, let's try to reproduce the telephoto experience in software as much as we can, and try to keep costs down, which is definitely why there are only two cameras on the back here.
I'm okay with there only being two cameras on the back, but yeah, that was the biggest disappointment in the Pixel 4 for me, was not having that wide angle lens for whenever I went to the parks and was trying to take a picture of, you know, take a picture of the castle or take a picture of the Millennium Falcon. And it's like, oh, I have to actually like pan in order to get this all in one shot.
Yeah.
I wonder too, just like with telephoto in general, like if people are really like attuned to that being a feature, just because like for forever you've been able to digitally zoom on a phone. And like, I don't know if like with a Pixel 4 or whatever phone you're talking about, if like they understand that you're getting a higher quality picture from zooming in when you could like technically do that on phones with a single sensor. Like with an ultra wide, it's immediately apparent like the upside you're getting to that, because you can't replicate that with just a primary camera lens.
Telephoto just never really worked that great for me on the Pixel 4.
I'm not a big fan of telephoto photography in general, at least not on a phone. But I do think it's kind of funny that, you know, like last year, they sort of brought out the Pixel 4 and they said, well, it only has a 2x telephoto, but we, you know, we're using all of this different computational data to give you a further range of zoom up to, I think, 5, maybe 10x. And then, you know, companies like Samsung and Huawei come along. They're like, hey, we can get up to 100x because we're using a much closer telephoto. And now it's, you know, it's sort of like Google's just kind of given up on that. They're like, all right, well, we'll just stick with 2x digital and do ultra wide instead.
Yeah, I mean, look, there's very little usable in 2x zoom on, like, it doesn't actually look very good if you don't have an optical lens that gives you that additional focal length. So Samsung even learned this the hard way by advertising 100 times space zoom on the Galaxy S20 Ultra, only to realize that most people posting those photos are posting like basically abstract art, because there's no detail to resolve at that focal length. But I also find it interesting that like Google is not so much admitting defeat as saying the market does not care enough about image quality, as opposed to just the fact that you could take an ultra wide photo. Most people are comfortable zooming in digitally and they don't really care that the photos aren't sharp. They just want to be able to do it. And functionally, the Pixel 5 should be able to get to 10x. It just won't look as good as it does on the Pixel 4. So at the end of the day, Google isn't so much removing a feature as it's just not telling you that the feature is as good as it used to be. And that's a lot of the same thing on the Pixel 5, right? There's no neural core, but Google is saying that it's going to have better quality photos because they've spent the year optimizing all the algorithms that, HDR Plus is comprised of, and the end result is going to be better quality photos.
It should also be as quick, if not quicker, to process those photos, right? Just because of better optimization, I guess, and quicker software.
Yeah, I mean, look, part of the promise of the 765 was that it has the same image signal processing and digital signal processing as the 865, and that the main thing you're losing is CPU and GPU power. But because most phones already have so much legroom when it comes to that, you're not really, you're not going to max out your phone's performance. No game really takes advantage of the Adreno 9 million in the 865 plus. So I guess the compromise there is Google has a better image signal processor for the Pixel 5 that it felt like it didn't need the dedicated neural core to process those HDR photos.
I will say one thing that I wish the 4A5, the Pixel 4A 5G has that the Pixel 5 got instead was the water resistance, because I guarantee you a lot of regular users don't really care that much about wireless charging, but water resistance is one of those things. If it's like, if somebody has kids or if somebody is like prone to doing yard work or going out and working out and getting caught in the rain, water resistance matters.
Yeah. Especially like it's forgivable to not have that on, say, a $350 phone like the regular 4A. But, you know, once you're starting to get up there in the price with the 4A 5G, you got to put it in there.
Yeah. Once you get up to 500 and above, you should have water resistance.
Yeah. I was going to say, can we talk about the wireless charging for a sec?
Yes, that's actually what I was going to bring up, because the body of this phone is really interesting. Google is releasing an aluminum phone, and I think it's the first aluminum, all metal phone that the company's had in the Pixel lineup. Or is it the first all metal phone that it's ever had? I'm just thinking, going all the way back to the Nexus line.
I think they had all metal ones in the Nexus line.
Oh yeah, the Nexus 6P obviously was famously all metal.
All metal.
Oh, I liked that thing, even though nobody else did.
I loved it. Yeah, that phone was underrated for sure.
Yeah.
So, yeah, this is an all metal phone, but it does not look like a brushed aluminum phone the way that the Nexus 6P did. This is covered in a very it's like a matte paint that Google told me is like a stone that you pick up that has been weathered by time. So it kind of feels like it's rough, but not that rough. It's not like sandpaper. It's just like there's a texture to it, but it's overall pretty smooth. What's really interesting is that Google managed to fit a wireless charging coil in an aluminum phone. And famously, aluminum is very difficult to work to make work properly with wireless charging. And before the show, when we heard about the fact that the Pixel 5 would be metal, we were trying to figure out how Google achieved this. And it turns out that they kind of cheated a little bit. So they, instead of putting in the time and increasing the costs to make a wireless charging coil actually conduct through metal, which would impede the signal quite a bit and force a much stronger antenna there, there's a physical hole cut out in the aluminum frame on the back. And what Google does is it fills in that hole with a bioresin. So it's basically an organic, a plastic made from organics of some sort. And they cover both the aluminum and the resin with the same paint, so that it looks it basically looks finished identically, and there's no way that you can tell the difference unless you cut into that paint. And I'm sure somebody's going to do that in less than a day after they get the phone. But right now, that is how Google is achieving this wireless charging. And I don't know, this is the most googly thing that they could have possibly done.
Yeah, it's so much like over-engineering for I don't know, not a useless thing, but just such like an out of left field design, I guess. I mean, like, I'm all for them bringing back aluminum phones, because I'd much rather have that as opposed to glossy, nasty glass backs. And that was one of my favorite design things about the Pixel 4, was that really nice matte glass finish, because it didn't look or feel like a regular glass back the way a Note 10 did that year.
Speak for yourself. I got the super glossy black one.
Ooh, yeah. That was a mistake. But yeah, if
I really like that one, actually.
Yeah, if this is a trend that like other companies can, if it's something they want to follow, like, I'm all for it. It is just kind of a hilarious thing for Google to like make this its mission for this phone. It's like, we're going for budget, affordable flagships, but by God, we're going to find a way to make wireless charging work in an aluminum phone for the first time.
So Google did say that the reason the phone is metal and not plastic is that to achieve the same structural integrity on a plastic phone, it needs to be a lot thicker. So obviously this phone is about the same thickness as the Pixel 4 XL, but it has a much bigger battery. And as a result, Google needed to put a metal frame in there to achieve that structural integrity and retain the thickness or thinness, I guess, of the previous generation. If it had gone with plastic, it would have been thicker. So this way you have, 97%, I don't know what the exact percentage, but 97% aluminum, a tiny cutout. It doesn't actually, it doesn't have to affect the structural integrity of the phone, which is an achievement, especially because this thing should be fairly hardy. It's not glass, right? So you're not going to shatter the back when you drop it on the floor. And as long as that resin holds up nicely, which it should because it's plastic, then there should be no quality control issues. But we'll see. I don't know. Let's talk a little bit about the 4A 5G for a minute. So $599 or $499, but it's only coming out on November 19th, whereas the Pixel 5 is coming out on October 29th. It's available in some countries on October 15th. I think Japan gets it earlier for some reason. But in the US and Canada, it's October 29th. The 4A 5G, though, later in November, very odd. We're not really sure why. Ara, what's your take on the 4A 5G and how it kind of fits into this lineup this year?
The Pixel 5 is pretty, and I love that green. But if I was going to recommend to somebody on the street, if they were like, hey, I want a new phone and I need a big screen. Like if my dad needed a new phone tomorrow because he hit it with a golf club or something or whatever, I would recommend to him to buy the Pixel 4a 5G, not because he needs 5G. I don't think there are a lot of people that can even really use 5G in 2020 or 2021, but because it's a quality phone with a big screen that's going to get updated for the next 3 years. And that's important. We need more phones that are going to get updated for a reasonable amount of time without costing $1,000 like the Galaxy S20 does.
I mean, would you still recommend the 4A 5G over the regular 4A, though?
Purely on size. That's why I prefaced it with if you need a big screen.
Yeah.
I mean, there are probably advantages to the 765 over the 730. It's just a newer generation. It's a more efficient chip. It is just like it's a better performing phone, all told. The battery should last a lot longer, and you don't lose out anything. You don't lose anything going from the Pixel 4a to the 4a 5g, but it is $150 more, and you have to really think about whether you're getting $150 worth of phone just by going to that larger display and getting 5g.
For me, like if I were recommending one of the two to somebody, like unless I guess if you're really insistent on having a bigger screen, but otherwise, most people, especially the people that are buying a Pixel 4a of any kind, probably don't really care about the processor inside because they just want something that's going to work and that's going to be affordable. I still think the 4a is a better buy for most people than the 5g. But I don't know. I mean, I guess it really just depends on how bad you need a bigger screen and the bigger battery.
You do also get that ultra wide though with the 4A 5G, which I don't know. I think that's a big deal for some people.
Yeah.
And I'll take it.
Yeah. I mean, I guess to Ara's point, like if you're going to somewhere like a park or something, you want to take some nice landscape shots. Yeah. The regular 4A is going to let you down there.
I don't think it's going to let you down. I just think you're going to have to stand a little bit further back from the action.
Yeah.
So I do want to talk Hayato, a little bit about the camera improvement, the video camera improvements on the Pixel 5 and even the Pixel 4a 5G, because I believe they both got the same update and they will, I think the same features will come to older Pixels with a feature drop. So Google is saying that not only will the Pixel 5 support 4K 60, which is a first for the Pixel line, but that a lot of care was taken to improve the experience of shooting video this year. And they are adding three specific video shooting modes, including a cinematic pan mode, which basically gives you the ability to move around in a stable way to, you know, you, when you shoot your B-roll for your YouTube videos, you are doing a cinematic pan. You are, you know, moving from left to right. You are making sure that your tripod is stable and that you're not getting any bumps along the way. And Google says that it has enough data, both from the optical image stabilization, but also from that sensor crop, plus all of the other algorithm improvements year over year, that it can eliminate most of that shake when you are doing a slow pan from left to right or up to down.
Yeah, I mean, I'm very excited to try that because, I mean, like you said, I do that all the time for my YouTube videos. Yeah, I'm not a big fan of the video crop on sensors to begin with. But if you're going to have it, I think this is a really good way to make use of that. You know, like it's basically just going to, from my understanding, it's just going to lock off an axis while you pan around, and you just get these super smooth shots as if you were on a tripod with a fluid head that you're panning with, which is what I have to use every time I need to get a pan with my cameras. So, you know, not needing an expensive tripod, an expensive fluid head, I think that's a big plus as long as it works well. What I didn't catch in their sort of event today was, do we know if it's going to work on both the X and the Y axis? Like if you want to do a vertical pan instead of horizontal, will that work as well?
I have no idea. The support documents are pretty new, but it's saying that there are three new modes. There's a locked mode for far away still shots. There's an active mode to capture heavy movement. And then there's a cinematic pan mode to capture smooth panning shots. Other than that, we don't really know a lot about it. The good news, though, is that even though right now these are exclusive to the Pixel 5 and 4a 5G, it does not seem like that will stay the fact for much longer. I would say that this will come to, I don't know, even going as far back as the Pixel 3, I have no data. I have no official word on that, but I would say that it's probably likely that this could be retroactively applied, given that most of it is just in software. Anything with OIS probably benefits from this.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's nice just because the Pixel has never really, video has never been a strong suit of the Pixel, right? Like the cameras are always, they blow us away with the photo capabilities because they have all of this AI processing, but they can't really apply that stuff to video quite as easily, and they can't do it in real time. So anything to make the video experience on the Pixel better, I'm definitely a fan of.
Yeah, and one thing that Mark Lavoie said in an interview with The Verge a couple of weeks ago, Mark Lavoie, as you mentioned, he left Google. He's now at Adobe building this like universal camera app for Android and iPhone. But what he had said after Nilay Patel posed a question about why can't Google achieve the same things with video as it does today with photos, is he's like, we just don't have the processing power to do what we need to do in real time, and it would take so long for these effects to be applied in post that most people wouldn't be interested in them. So it's nice to see that Google is taking steps to sort of recreate HDR Plus in some small way on video. And I don't mean by applying effects in real time, which are already applied to some extent, right? HDR does apply in video, but this makes taking video on a Pixel phone actually, I would say, fun. It seems like this will be a much better experience overall. And the fact that Google is kind of leaning into the features of taking video and figuring out why people, you know, what kind of video people shoot on their phones, that leads me to believe that the next generation and the one after that, they're not just going to forget about video again for a couple right. more years. They're really going to take it seriously from now on, the same way that they've been doing that with photos every year.
Well, I just wanted to say that, like, to be clear, this is still not going to be, I wouldn't say this will be one of the best video experiences on Android still, because it's still missing things like manual video controls that you would get on something like the LG V60 or the Sony Xperia 1 Mark II. You know, if you really want to do some super cinematic videos with your phone and make some like mini documentary or something, this is still not going to be the right phone for that necessarily, but it's still just nice to have these extra features that do make it a bit more competitive, because before it was just not a great option for video in the past. So really just making it better without going overboard, I think was the right move. Because otherwise, you know, that sort of super simple, just point and click experience with the Pixel would start to get watered down with all these manual controls.
I was going to say, I wonder if like this is maybe a sign that in the next year or two, we finally see Google upgrade that 12.2 megapixel primary sensor we've had for, I don't know, 2 or 3 years at this point. Just because like if they're going to make like any kind of like what Hayato was saying, if they're going to make substantial like leaps or substantial progress with video quality, like I feel like you have to at some point address the hardware of it. Like what Google can do with software is like really impressive, but like the conversation has to happen like down the road of like if we're going to take video seriously, like there probably has to be some sort of sensor upgrade for these phones.
I don't think necessarily so, because I mean, 12 megapixels is actually perfectly fine for 4K video. I mean, unless they want to start getting into 8K, but you know, you look at some professional cameras like Sony's new A7S III, even that camera only has a 12.4 megapixel sensor. You know, I think it's plenty of resolution. I mean, maybe they could upgrade the actual lens or something, but I don't think they need to necessarily size up in resolution or anything.
No, but the sensor has been, it's the same sensor as the one on the Pixel 2.
Sure, so, but it's still putting out great images.
Yeah, I was going to ask that earlier. Do you think that the additions this year to the photo-taking feature, the photo-taking experience is, you know, notable year over year? So, you know, Aura, we had Night Sight last year. We had, I forget what we had with the Pixel 3, but it felt like, you know, Night Sight was Pixel 3. Last year was Astro Mode. We had, you know, every year we've had major additions to the camera suite. This year we're getting the ultra wide lens, obviously, and cinematic pan, which you talked about, but the other photo taking experiences don't seem that impressive. We have Night Sight on portrait mode. We have portrait lighting.
Yeah, I have
lighting.
Serious doubts about how that's going to work out, honestly. I never use Night Sight, even when I'm in the parks, just because I can't keep my hand still for that long. So I'm really looking forward to seeing how selfies are going to work, considering most of the selfies on a Pixel are not OIS, if memory serves. Those are all fixed focal length.
See, and I love Night Sight even in broad daylight, just because it sort of rounds out the highlights and just, I guess, it flattens the image a bit, even if it's not like super low light. It's just a nice different look that I definitely enjoy.
I mean, I'd use it if I could actually keep my hand steady enough for it, but I can't.
Sure.
So it's a moot point for me.
Yeah.
I will say that even the photo samples that Google posted in its blog post for Night Sight in portrait mode are not good.
Yeah,
like
that's reassuring.
Real not good. So the best photos that Google could come up with for its launch event do not look like photos that I would want to share on the internet for Night Sight in portrait mode. I don't really know what that says, but you know, hopefully they'll improve it with updates.
Maybe if you're propping your phone up on something so you don't have to actually, you know, touch the phone while it takes the picture. But yeah, I'm not optimistic.
Maybe the most impressive update to the camera experience is actually nothing to do with the camera at all and will affect a lot more people than just Pixel owners. Google Photos is getting a new photo editor, finally. It's the first major overhaul for the photo editor since Google Photos was released 5 years ago. Google obviously took that photo editor largely unchanged from Snapseed, but removed all the expert features, and I don't actually like using the photo editor in Google Photos. This one simplifies it. It gives you a lot more features. It we'd seen previews of this earlier, but overall, it does look like this one will just be a more comprehensive and more enjoyable experience overall. Ara, what's your take on this update to the Google Photos editor?
I'm anxious, but also a little bit excited because I'm somebody who I work full time on a Chromebook. So I do a lot of my photo editing on Google Photos. And for the most part, I get what I need to out of it. So it's going to be interesting to see how much easier it is to edit it on a phone now. Because I haven't been a big fan of editing with Google Photos on a phone compared to using it on the website. But I'm hopeful that they keep it intuitive, but still give us enough of the granularity that it's still easy enough to tweak it exactly the way we want, especially in regards to saturation and contrast.
Yeah, I want the manual controls to be better. I don't love the manual controls right now in Google Photos. And actually, I've started using Lightroom Mobile on all of my Android phones because it is so good and so mm-hmm. much easier to use than it used to be. So if this keeps me from having to open a second app to edit all my photos, I'll be pretty happy about that.
Yeah. I will say I don't edit nearly enough photos actually on my phone. I always just throw it to a Chromebook because they're always handy.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if you're using a Chromebook, why not? All right. So last thing about the phones before we move on to the other products, there's a new Hold For Me feature, which will come to the Pixel 4a, 5G and Pixel 5 in the US first. It's basically a Google Assistant feature, duplex powered, that allows you to use your phone while you wait for a support person or any other somebody that has you on hold, essentially a bank or some other telecom support person, and it'll just call you back when it's ready. And I think that's kind of awesome and really does address a pain point that a lot of people feel when you're sitting on the phone, you don't really want to use your phone because you might hang up on that person. Hey Otto, what's your take on Hold For Me? And will it actually affect how you make calls to, these companies that everybody dreads?
I think so, yeah. I mean, I feel like everybody kind of hates being on the phone more than they have to. And the whole thing with Hold For Me, it doesn't necessarily call you back. What it does is basically there's going to be a button in the phone app that'll just, say, do you want to use Hold For Me? You tap it once there's, Hold Music. And it just sits through all of that. It can identify not just Hold Music, but also those sort of pre-recorded messages when, some voice will just say, thanks for holding. We'll be with you in a minute. It knows that that's still not a real person. And so it doesn't give you this sort of false positive of like, hey, somebody's ready for you now. And basically once there is somebody back on the other end of the line, it basically buzzes your phone. It sends you an audible notification, and while it's waiting for you to sort of come back to the phone, it'll tell the person on the other end. It sort of flips the table on them. It says, "Hey, now you have to wait while they get back to the phone." I think on one hand that's a really good thing because obviously that's very convenient for the user, right? Like you don't have to sit around and wait for 5 minutes, sometimes an hour or even longer on hold. But also, I think it could lead to some problems that Duplex has already sort of created, where as soon as the person on the other end picks up the phone and they hear this voice from Google Assistant saying, please wait for the person to get back to the phone, they're gonna hang up. Right.
Like right. I can already tell you I'm very grateful for this use, for this ability, but all it needs to do is just buzz. It either needs to buzz or play one audible ding and then turn on the mic so that way I can talk immediately.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that would be a good solution. I mean, I guess the other problem there is if you're not ready, if I'm waiting on hold, I tend to be doing things like washing the dishes or something else. Maybe I'm playing guitar. I don't necessarily want the person on the other end to just hear that automatically without me being ready. But it would probably cause fewer issues than this automated voice talking back to them. What I do like though, is that if there is somebody talking on the other end and you want to maybe Google just doesn't catch it and you want to make sure that, you're actually staying on top of the call when you're not listening, they're basically doing their live transcription in real time for the phone call. So you can just turn that on at any time without unmuting yourself. And without, I think without turning on the audio from their end as well, you can just see a transcription of if anybody's talking, maybe that automated voice, you can just sort of read that in real time. So I think that's a really nice feature to add on to this.
Yeah, I'm kind of bummed that it's not rolling out outside the US yet, but
yeah,
this is, I think, going to save a lot of people a lot of hassle. So this is yet another Google feature that only the company could make. And it just makes it makes sense, especially when we're all at home now. We all just want to put our phones down when we're on hold and come back when, you know, only when we need to. So,
and the nice thing is it's coming to not just the new Pixels that were announced today, but it's going to be rolling out to other Pixel devices in a sort of the feature drop that Google does from time to time.
Yeah, exactly. Quarterly, I think. So, all right. One more quick thing about the Pixel phone. So there's a new, you know, you can now screen share in HD with Google Duo. I don't think it's I don't think that's Pixel only, but let's check. No, it's to everybody. So that's cool. There's new features in Google Recorder. So the Pixel 4 debuted this insane recorder app that lets you transcribe your conversations, and it's very accurate. It's all so done good. Locally. Now you can actually edit the text in that transcription, and it will delete the associated audio waveform, which is bananas. And again, only something Google seems to be able to do well. What was that company that also does this? It starts with O. Oyster, but they just got snapped up by, they just got acquired. So there is a bit of competition in this space, but Google really does this better than any other company. And obviously it's free, which the other one is not. Otter is the company that I was thinking of. Anyway, but this looks incredible. I cannot wait to use this for interviews. And then finally, if you buy a Pixel 4a 5G or Pixel 5, you get 3 months of Stadia, 3 months of YouTube Premium, 100 gigs of Google One storage, and Google Play Pass and silver status or gold status on Play Points for 3 months. So, you know, quite a few nice offers there if you do buy the phone. And then, as I said earlier, the 4A 5G launches in Japan on October 15th and 8 other countries, including the US and Canada, in November. And then the Pixel 5 comes to 8 countries on October 15th, but the US and Canada on October 29th. No idea why that's happening, but Australia, France, Germany, Ireland, Japan, Taiwan, the UK get them all before we do. So, boo earns.
And there's also a little bit of confusion too about the 4A 5G as a sub 6 model and also a millimeter wave model. And I guess there's some discrepancies with the pricing there. So once all these US carriers announce their availability and price information for that, it'll be interesting to see like how much of a difference there is and how Google kind of works their messaging around that.
Yeah, I mean, the unlocked Pixel 5 supports millimeter wave in the US, but T-Mobile and AT&T really don't use millimeter wave right now. So it feels like it's just an added cost that may benefit some people down the road, but it really doesn't feel like it does. Also, somebody in my briefing asked about when Google Fi will add millimeter wave support because it currently uses T-Mobile. And the person said soon, but we won't comment right now on when. So stay tuned for that. All right, we'll take a quick break and we will come back to talk about the Nest Audio. Be right back. This episode of the Android Central podcast is brought to you by Indeed. One of the greatest challenges we all face is taking all the information that's available and knowing where to focus. It's that same problem we run into with hiring too. But with Indeed, you have access to the largest pool of talent and can hire the right people fast. Indeed.com is the number one job site in the world because Indeed gets you the best people fast. Unlike other sites, Indeed gives you full control and payment flexibility over your hiring. You pay only for what you need. You can pause your account at any time, and there are no long-term contracts. Plus, Indeed provides powerful tools to make your search that much easier, like sponsored jobs, which are known to be 3.5 times more likely to result in a hire. With 73% of online job seekers visiting Indeed each month, Indeed is going to get you the important hire you need, just like they have for over 3 million businesses. Right now, Indeed is offering our listeners a free $75 credit to boost your job post, which means more quality candidates will see it fast. Try Indeed out with a free $75 credit at Indeed.com/ACP. This is their best offer anywhere. Go right now to Indeed.com/ACP. Terms and conditions apply. Ara, I guess this is more exciting for you than for me, but I am curious to know why you are excited about $99 Nest Audio. It is the successor, the spiritual successor to the Google Home, which was released incredibly 4 years ago.
In 2016. And I remember it vividly because I bought it after doing a morning of overtime working on election graphics.
Exactly. All right. So give us the lowdown. What do you get for your $100 and why is this exciting to you?
It's exciting to me because Google's smart speakers haven't really been that interesting or really changed that much in the last 3 years. Like since we got the original Google Home Mini, we haven't really, and the Google Home Max, those two came out together. Since the two of those, we haven't really had much of anything new from any Google Assistant speakers, apart from a couple of third-party speakers, which are cool, but don't get updated as quickly as the Google ones. So the Nest Audio is a nice, good, medium size where you're going to get really good sound, where you're going to get a good quality of sound out of it, and you're going to get a good volume out of it. The original Google Home could fill your room okay. Google Home Mini can't really fill a room the way you want it to. So I'm grateful to see that, but also we're getting a good variety of colors this time. Thank you, Lord. The original Google Home only came in one color, and the Echo, the Max only comes in two colors, and the Mini, we get four now, assuming you can actually find any of them in stock. So I'm grateful that we get five colors this time, and that we get a more premium-looking package without a more premium-looking price, considering this is actually $30 cheaper than the Google Home was when it launched.
Yeah, I was pretty surprised to see only $100 for the price. That's really, really competitive, honestly.
I mean, it's the same price as the Amazon Echo. So sure, the price makes sense, but I'm also very grateful to see it. Although I think that the speaker on this one is going to be bigger and beefier than the one on the new Amazon Echo.
Yeah, that's definitely the thing I'm most interested in seeing, just because I've got a ton of speakers and displays with Google Assistant on them throughout my apartment. Like I found I definitely get the most use out of the smart displays for obvious reasons, just because you can see answers to questions, you can follow recipes and watch YouTube videos and all that. But I've been looking for just some good speakers for my desk to listen to music through that's not the built-in speaker on the iMac. So assuming this sounds good, I'm not expecting Sonos One quality, obviously, just because there's a big price gap. If it sounds pretty good and I can pair two of them for $99 each, and you also benefit from having an assistant packed in there too, it is potentially really exciting, and I am really loving that that minty green color. So
I'm in love with the blue, blue and the pink and the green. I just love all of them. I want to take them all home.
Yeah, if the audio is there, I'm definitely probably going to pick up a couple of these. But all depends on if Google could actually fit in good speakers for $99, which probably isn't an easy thing to do.
Well, judging by the improvements between the original Google Home Mini and the Nest Mini, which it's the same looking speaker, but the audio quality is considerably improved. I'm sure this does sound better than the original Google Home. It's not hard to sound better than the Nest Hub, which is basically not a speaker you want to listen to music on.
It's not good.
And it does kind of fit a nice medium or a nice, happy spot between the Nest Hub or the Nest Mini and the Google Home Max. I hate these names so much.
Yep.
So I use a Google Home Max every day in our living room. It still sounds incredible. This apparently has a 75% louder max volume, and the bass is 50% more substantial. I don't know what that means by Google standards, but you know, the original Google Home sounded good, and the bass response was pretty meager. So I'm excited to hear it. And honestly, given the fact that like the only real competitors that I can think of, as you said, were the fourth gen Echo, which also got a nice redesign this year, and the IKEA Symphonic Sonos speaker, which is $99. I have two of them in my office, and they sound pretty good. So once I get my hands on this Nest Audio in a pair of them, I'm going to do a bunch of testing to see which ones sound better.
I'm also, one feature from the Google Home Max that I'm grateful is making its way to the Nest Audio is the ability to adapt to whatever room it's in, to adapt its sound profile. They didn't mention it during the presentation, but it's in the Google store listing. So I'm very happy for that. So,
you know who did mention the fact that Google offers, automatic room adjustment?
Who?
Is Sonos, when they sued Google earlier this week for patent infringement, because one of those patents was for TruePlay, which Google apparently, according to this lawsuit, has basically copied and reproduced in its Google Home speakers. So what that means is that, you know, Google may be on the hook for a lot of money if a court decides that it did commit patent infringement. But at this point, you know, nothing's come of that because the lawsuit was just filed. So really, really interesting times. This is the second lawsuit that Sonos has filed against Google for these kinds of features.
Fun note, one of the patents in that lawsuit that Sonos filed in Waco, Texas this week is a patent that was issued 2 weeks ago. So it's going to be interesting to see how well that shakes out.
Yeah,
although I find it hilarious that Texas is becoming a patent infringement hotbed again.
Maybe because it just has a bunch of judges that are willing to take these cases up, and an environment where these kinds of lawsuits are welcome in the courts. It's unclear whether this will have any effect on Google's product roadmap down the road, but yeah, I don't know. It's just something that we need to always keep in the back of our minds, that like as good as Google is at this smart home speaker stuff, it's largely, I mean, I can't say for sure because we don't know whether they infringed on these patents, but it does seem like many of these ideas were taken from Sonos, which has been doing this for over a decade now. So
yeah, but one of those patents is changing the volume for your speaker from your phone. I mean, that's a pretty basic thing to patent.
Well, it is and it isn't, right? Because, you know, if there's, like, it's kind of hard to know, you know, if say I open up Spotify or something and I have Spotify Connect streaming to my Sonos, does it, when I press the volume button on my phone, does it increase my phone volume or does it increase my Sonos speaker volume? These speakers have to know what is an active and what is a background service, and it has to think about which one it should adjust on the fly. And obviously Sonos has thought about this because it changed that behavior on iOS a couple of years ago, much to the chagrin of a lot of Sonos users. And they clearly patented that because it was a consideration that they made very early on. So not saying that that Google infringed or that whatever, it's just that these small things that get patented are done for a reason. And it's because later on, if another company copies them wholesale, they can go and sue them in Texas and hopefully get a lot of money out of them.
That's the dream.
Good luck.
Yeah, that's the dream. Let's all just go sue companies in Texas and hope to make a windfall that way. That seems like an easier job than journalism. All right. So what else about this Nest speaker? It comes out in early October and or mid-October. And yeah, I don't know. It doesn't seem like there's much else interesting about it, unless I missed anything.
No, I mean, it's pretty, it isn't an over-the-top update. So I'm happy that there's nothing that they're trying to, like, they're not trying to go for any, like, showboating with it. They're trying to just do things that they know that they can do and know they can do well. Although, I really, really wish they could have put at least a small battery in this thing, so that way I could transfer it from room to room, instead of having to have one in every room and rely on assistant shoving the audio from one to the other as I walk.
That was rumored.
I really wish they would have announced a Nest thermostat update.
Yeah, that too.
We did see a patent for, or at least an FCC filing for a new Nest thermostat. So it's definitely coming. It just might not be ready right now. So hopefully in the next few
Maybe
months.
Maybe at I.O. next year.
Yeah, virtual I.O. All right, so let's take another quick break and we will come back and talk about this new Chromecast, because that is a thing that is happening. Google is getting back into the Android TV hardware game, and it comes with a remote that Google says it wants you to think of as a bowl of candy. I don't really know what that means. We'll come back and talk about it. This episode of the Android Central podcast is brought to you by Roman. Talking about erectile dysfunction isn't easy. Usually, we just brush it off or blame ourselves, saying things like, I lost my mojo. Or we avoid it altogether with excuses like, I had a long day at work, or sorry, honey, I'm just not feeling it. But with Roman, it is easy to talk about it. With a healthcare professional who can prescribe real medication. It's simple, safe, and totally discreet. With Roman, you can get a free online evaluation and ongoing care for ED, all from the comfort and privacy of your home. A healthcare professional will work with you to find the best treatment plan. If medication is appropriate, Roman will ship it to you with free 2-day shipping. The whole process is straightforward, simple, and discreet. Getting started is simple too. Just go to GetRoman.com/ACP and complete an online visit. Erectile dysfunction used to be tough to tackle, but now there's Roman. Complete an online visit today to connect with a healthcare professional and take care of it. Go to GetRoman.com/ACP today. If approved, you'll get $15 off your first order of ED treatment. That's GetRoman.com/ACP. All right, so Joe Maring, you are right after this going out to pick up a Chromecast with Google TV.
Yes.
What is a Chromecast with Google TV, and how does it differ from the other two Chromecasts that Google has released, or three, if you count the recent Chromecast visual update, over the years?
So it's similar in the sense where, like, it looks like a dongle. You plug in your HDMI port on your TV, and you can still send content to it from the little Chromecast icon on your phone. But now you actually get a legit user interface on the TV with a remote that you can browse through and find content that way. So basically, like, a kind of a refresh of the Nexus player, whenever that was a thing. The interesting thing is that it is, the official name is Chromecast with Google TV, which is a separate interface on top of the Android TV we currently have. And the big push there is that it tries to put a bigger emphasis on, like, recommending content that Google thinks you're interested in. So there's a whole For You homepage that's going to give you picks from all of your streaming apps based on what Google thinks you want to watch. You kind of have some of that with the little channels that currently exist on Android TV, but it's really putting that at the forefront of it. It's a visual refresh. I mean, it's still functionally, you click on your apps to watch what you want to watch. There's still Netflix, Disney Plus, Prime Video, all of that stuff. Right now, they're keeping the interface to just the Chromecast with Google TV, but starting next year, they're going to look at other hardware devices to expand it to. So it sounds like some stream boxes and televisions with Android TV built in will get the new interface. Others might not. And that could get really confusing just because it is Android TV, but it's not Android TV. Android TV is still sticking around, and it's all a big mess that only Google could do with its branding.
Oh, and don't forget, that's also what they're renaming their TV and movies app for Android and iOS. So it's also going to be Google TV on the website and Google TV on the apps. So no, not confusing at all.
All right, walk us through what Google TV is, because Google TV already existed as a product before Android TV existed. And now it's back, but it is not the same thing at all. But it resembles Google TV in the sense that it is sort of focused on live TV and streaming. Help us figure out what it is.
Okay, Google TV now is just a software interface that's designed to help you find content and view the content that you want without getting lost in different app menus and browsing for half an hour to an hour the way that I do sometimes before I make dinner. So it's designed to help, what's the phrase? It's helped to gather the content that it thinks that you want to watch and present it in a easy to browse, easy to, it's hoping to help simplify the decision of what you want to watch. Because when you sit down in front of the TV and I'm like, okay, what do I want to watch today? Because right now you have to pick your app first and it's like, okay, what do I want to watch on Netflix? Or do I want to go look at Hulu for a while? Or hey, Disney Plus is here. Should I look at anything over there?
Right. So it's basically like it's Apple TV's TV app. It's like Roku's sort of section. It's like its channels, the front of its channels app. It's curating content based on your previous watching history that it thinks you would recommend, that it thinks you would enjoy. Consolidated from a whole bunch of different services that have bought into this idea of a hub, right?
Yeah, because you apps still have to make the content visible to Google TV as opposed to just having the app on Android TV. So it's going to be very interesting to see whether or not Google TV gets enough services to actually buy into this as opposed to how things are on Android TV right now, where most Android TV apps, all you have is an app icon on the front page or in the app drawer because they don't populate a channel further down on your home screen.
And it's clear Netflix is not going to buy into this because it has no interest in doing so on Apple TV, where far more eyeballs are. So
I don't know about that, because Netflix was mentioned by name in the Google TV announcer.
And they do have a channel on Android TV that like kind of does recommended shows. So I'd imagine like any service that has the channel support on Android TV is going to support this. And I'm sure Google's going to make a much bigger push to bring any lingering services to this, just because the whole channel idea for Android TV never really took off, I think, the way Google was hoping for.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, look, there's clearly interest in this sort of curation, especially since there are so many services right now. Google calls out Disney Plus, HBO Max, Netflix, Peacock, Rakuten, YouTube, a lot of others as well. You also get 6 months of free Netflix standard with a purchase of this, which is basically worth more than your Chromecast itself, which is
interesting. Actually, I don't think you do. At least on the Google Store. On the Google Store, they have two separate listings. They have a Google TV with Chromecast with Google TV, and then they have a Chromecast with Google TV plus Netflix. And the one with Netflix is $30 more.
Yeah, and that's 6 months of it, which is a deal, but you're still spending a bit more up front. I think the whole thing with this, it's kind of a small feature, but I'm personally looking forward to, is that Google mentioned, if you're just like on Google search and you search for a TV show or a movie, if you tap the button on the Google search result that like adds it to your watch list, it puts it on the watch list that's like integrated with your Chromecast with Google TV. Because like right now I use a third party app called Just Watch, where if I want to like look for a movie that I'm not sure what streaming service it's going to be on. It's like you look it up on Google and then you compare it to that app and add it to your watch list and everything. So if there's like a more streamlined way to kind of find shows you want to watch and then see what services those might be on, like I'm all for making that process a little less headache inducing because it can be a mess if you're subscribed to 5 or 6 different streaming services and don't know what show is on which one with licenses changing all the time.
Yeah, that is really interesting. It does look like Netflix is part of this for you section. So I'm wrong about that. But there is also a dedicated Netflix button on the remote. So I'm mm-hmm. sure that is part of the equation that Netflix gets a ton more visibility than any of the other services.
I'm really hoping that's a remappable button because I don't actually use Netflix that much. I'll go binge something every couple of weeks, but it's not the kind of thing that I tune in every week for any of their shows.
I mean, I think remappable branded buttons are kind of funny though, because then you just hit the Netflix button and it takes you to like Hulu or Disney Plus or something.
So long as it works, man.
You know somebody is going to hack this firmware and remap the button in like 2 days.
Oh, I'm hoping it's in the settings, because that's how it is on the NVIDIA Shield. The Shield, you can remap, there's a button that you can remap to whatever app you want.
Yeah, I have to imagine if Netflix is like paying for that placement, though, there's not an out-of-the-box way to just overgo that. There could be.
I would guarantee you there is no easy way to remap this button. But, you know, maybe Google will prove me wrong. I do like the remote, though. I think, you know, mm-hmm. looking at this remote compared to the Apple TV remote, it's not even close. Like, this one just looks like a much better experience overall.
It's and pretty, finally, especially the blue and the pink ones.
Finally, you get a remote with a Chromecast, which is something that people have been asking for. Even without a UI as comprehensive as this, people have just been wanting a way to interact with Chromecast for years.
Without having to pull up their phone every single time.
Yeah. The one thing that I'm a little hesitant about is that, because like there are a few different like sections or pages that the Google TV interface has. And one of those is a dedicated live section, which obviously integrates with YouTube TV. If you're like myself and you're not subscribed to YouTube TV, I'm hoping that doesn't become too annoying and they don't really try to shove that down your throat. And it would be nice if they could expand this to like Sling TV and other strict live TV services. But once again, I have a feeling Google's going to kind of shut that off and just use it as a ground to really push YouTube TV on people.
They mentioned that they're going to start bringing other live subscription services, quote unquote, coming soon. So it's not just going to be YouTube TV. But at the same time, I'm very much hoping that if you're not subscribed to a live TV service already, that app, that tab just won't appear.
Mm-hmm.
Or if it does appear, it's one of those things of if you're not subscribed, you can turn it off. Because please, dear God, don't make me scroll past 4 or 5 different tabs in order to get over to apps.
Yeah.
Although I'm very happy that movies and shows are going to have their own for everything that you've purchased from Google.
There is a reason that this is $50 and it is being subsidized by the services that Google is bundling here, right? So yes, I'm cynical about this, but the live tab will probably try to upsell you like crazy to anything that Google supports. So obviously YouTube TV makes sense. But if Google can get other brands on board, you know, if they can try to upsell you on anything, then they will do that because they have to subsidize this hardware somehow. This is a more powerful, more feature-filled version of the Chromecast Ultra. It supports 4K HDR. It supports Dolby Vision, Dolby Audio. It is just a better overall experience, and it's cheaper than that Chromecast Ultra as well. So you'd imagine there's a reason a lot of these bundles are happening.
Well, I'd pay an extra $30 to not have the live tab smack me in the face every time I try to go watch my shows.
Yeah, I mean, let's see. Maybe it's not as in your face as we think it'll be, but I don't hold out a ton of hope there. So what else can we talk about with this? It's available right now. So that's, you know, something you can go and buy today if you want. It is.
If they have any near you.
One thing is interesting. You can't play Stadia on it until next year.
It's the most Google thing I've ever heard of. Like, I understand because, like, they have very, like, distinct teams working on different services and products, but it seems like such an oversight of if this is, like, their big future for gaming and, like, they're really trying to be serious about Stadia and get that in front of a lot of people's eyeballs. Like, it's almost bewildering that it can run on a Chromecast Ultra, but you're making people wait months before they can use it on this new hardware that is probably going to get purchased by a lot of people during Black Friday and the holiday shopping season that's coming up. Like, it's such a bizarre oversight, but, like, Google's done weirder things.
This is a Chromecast, and you cannot cast Stadia to it. Like, what the heck, guys? Like, this is basic stuff.
I think, so there's a couple of things here, right? You can sideload Stadia onto this dongle, and therefore it works today. We've seen it tested already. The Verge's Chris Welch actually bought this a couple of days ago because Home Depot sold him one. He tested Stadia as a sideload. It works fine. It's clearly just an integration optimization question. Like, this, as Joe mentioned, the Stadia team probably hasn't QA'd the experience and therefore wants to wait until it's in better shape or has tighter integration into Google TV. But yeah, I mean, underneath this, it's still an Android TV box. It's the same Android TV that's running on the NVIDIA Shield and the TiVo streaming stick and the Xiaomi Mi Box S and the whatever, and all the Android TVs that are sold with, well, all the TVs that are sold to Android TV today. Joe, you actually have a Hisense Android TV in your home. Would you, I mean, you're going to because you've already bought it, but like this is obviously a dongle that you put in an HDMI port and power behind your TV. I'm interested to hear what you think about whether this is interesting to you, right? If you're just a tech fan, does this Google TV overlay interest you when you already have that Android TV experience?
Yeah, like I don't hate the way that Android TV works in its current form, but I'm just kind of always happy to try out a new user interface and get familiar with it and see how it works. And like, the content curation that Google TV does over Android TV is probably reason enough for me to at least try it. And it seems like it's going to make finding something to watch a bit more convenient. And also as someone with some of the remotes you get with those like Hisense or any other TV manufacturers, they look like they come out of 1990. So I'm more than happy to go to something that's a bit simpler with that remote that Google includes and is a little more pleasing to hold. And if it's going to make me think of a jar of candy or something, then I'm all for that. But yeah, for like most people, I mean, if you have an Android, like a built-in Android TV television, and assuming that Google TV is like pushed out to most of those devices, and like this obviously isn't something that most people need to buy, but if you're still rocking like a dumb TV or something with Fire TV or Roku built in and you want to give it a shot, then like it's $50. It'll probably see some kind of small discount once we get into the shopping season. And I hope it's a big hit for them, because I would love to see kind of a renaissance of Android TV, because it gets a lot of hate and a lot of trash, but it's gotten quite good in the past year or so.
Yeah. I mean, on the other hand, Chromecast is easily Google's biggest hardware hit. So calling this a Chromecast as opposed to an Android TV, like Android TV is nowhere in this name, and that's not an accident. So yeah,
I think it may not be in the name, but it is in the product.
Well, it's powered by Android TV, but that doesn't mean this is interesting, right? Because Google is doing to itself what Samsung and LG and other Android manufacturers do to Android itself. Right, Samsung doesn't release phones with Android 10. It releases it with One UI 2.5. Android is powering the experience, but it's not prominent anywhere in the branding. And Google is essentially doing the same thing here. It's overlaying its own software with a Google-branded experience. And if you look at it from that perspective, it makes sense, because Android TV has never been particularly pretty. And even NVIDIA... You know, NVIDIA releases a Shield that obviously uses Android TV, but it's done its own optimizations and it has its own reasons for existing. And NVIDIA is the one OEM that is pushing Google to make changes to Android TV when it makes sense to, right?
Yeah, and like the Android name in general, like it was not an exact same situation, but we had the rebrand from Android Wear to Wear OS, where again, like Google is just kind of like pushing away from the Android brand a little bit. I mean, I'm not sure how much weight Wear OS has over Android Wear, but like we've had a couple instances now where Google has shown that it's fine to rebrand something that previously had Android in the name and give it, you know, something else that just kind of drops it entirely. Which I mean, you could say, like, does it beg the question that Android as a whole gets a rebrand at some point if you want to think that far down the road? But it's definitely something that like they're thinking about and they're actively doing with some of these rebrands. And I think the next year or two down the road, it'll be, you know, fascinating to see if Android Auto gets a similar rebrand or like what else they do with that name.
Well, I mean, there's already Android Automotive, so I don't think the Android Auto name is going away, but Google is a company where it feels like there are a lot of competing factions. Some advocate for Android as a brand, some advocate for Android just as an underlying engineering layer where things can live on top of it. And I think where it serves them, it makes sense to keep it, and where it doesn't, it serves to get rid of it.
Well, I'm sure that all the antitrust stuff around Android over the last several years has had something to do with this as well.
Yes, that's fair. Not to mention the fact that, you know, right now, if you buy an Android phone in Europe, it's not the same experience as if you buy it here in the US. So that is a very, very good point, Ara. All right. Anything else about the Android, the Google Chromecast with Google TV?
I don't like
if
the name.
If you want one, you should get one now, because I've looked and it's the blue one is sold out everywhere that I have tried to buy it, including Google.
Wow.
Yeah, a lot of the stores, it looks like you can get a pickup on October 8th or 10th or so. So like you have to wait a couple days, but it's not like waiting for a Series X or something. Like it should be pretty easy to get within the next few days or so.
All right, well, we're going to take another quick break and we'll come back and finish the show with what's making us happy. This episode of the Android Central podcast is brought to you by SanDisk. We've all experienced the problem of running out of storage space on our phones, and that's why we've been talking about SanDisk over the last few weeks, the global leader in data storage solutions that has you covered no matter what smartphone you have. A few months ago, I made the mistake of buying a phone with the minimum amount of storage, 64 gigabytes, that you should buy with a phone today, and I ran out of storage pretty darn quickly. But that's why I use SanDisk's Ultra Dual Drive Lux USB Type-C flash drive with capacities from 32 gigs all the way up to 1 terabyte for my storage. The Dual Drive Lux has 150 megabyte per second read speeds that let you transfer photos and videos faster. Plus, SanDisk makes other great products for both Android and Apple devices, like the Extreme Micro SD UHS 1 card and the iXpand Flash Drive Go. Take our advice. Free up space on your phone with SanDisk. Right now, get 10% off your first order of these SanDisk products, but only when you go to sandisk.com/ACP. That's SANDISK.com/ACP. Don't wait. Go to sandisk.com/ACP. And thanks, SanDisk, for sponsoring the Android Central podcast. Okay, so Ara, you are being subjected to what's making us happy first, because I don't think you've done it yet. And I'd love to hear what is making you happy, because it's usually pretty fun.
Well, if I thought about this, I would have grabbed a prop before I came in here. But it's October tomorrow, and that means that it's pumpkin season, and pumpkin seeds are making me happy.
You are very good at making pumpkin seeds. You make the nicest looking pumpkin seeds I think I've ever seen.
Well, they take like 4 to 6 hours. They ought to be good.
That's a very long time.
Well, I gut the pumpkin and then I brine the seeds for like 2 hours, and then I dry the seeds for like 3 hours, and then they bake for like an hour. So it takes time.
That is that's a lot of work. It sounds like it's worth it, though.
They're like the perfect fall snack. You get fiber from the hulls of the seeds. You get fat and protein from the actual seeds themselves. And the butter adds a little bit of saltiness, and it's just so crunchy and delicious. Love them.
If your recipe isn't secret, I'll have to steal it from you, because Kennedy and I tried to make pumpkin seeds last year, and they were very not good. I don't know what we screwed up with them.
Same.
Yeah.
Oh, no, I've shared my recipe before. I should have shared it in the editor's desk this week, honestly.
I think you did one time. For some reason, I think I remember
I did it
you.
A couple years ago.
Yeah.
But I've been continually improving it.
Yeah, I'll have to give that a shot sometime soon. I'd like to make some pumpkin seeds that aren't repulsive.
Same. All right. Maybe there's a side hustle in your future, Ara.
Oh, yes, because I have so much free time in the fall.
All right, Joe, what's making you happy?
Mine's pretty boring. It's that I have a new router now. For the past, like, ever since we moved into this new apartment, I've had constant issues with, like, our Google Meet meetings. Like, I'd always cut in and out and would have to join from my phone using my LTE connection. I could not stay connected to Wi-Fi in the bedroom, which is just, like, down the hall. So being able to just have a Wi-Fi router that works and isn't a constant source of stress throughout the day has been a great addition to the apartment, and has made my, if I was wearing the Fitbit Sense still, my stress meter, my score would probably be far better than it was a week ago. So I'm very appreciative for that. Routers aren't very fun on their own, but when they don't work, they are a bit maddening.
You got Wi-Fi 6 on that boy?
It does. I'm Wi-Fi 6ing it up in here. Fancy
your
stuff.
Your video streams are still a little choppy, so I don't know. Maybe there's some optimizations there, or you got to bring the router closer to your computer. But at least it's not dropping anymore, so that's something.
Take the progress I can get.
Yeah, exactly. All right, Hayato, what's making you happy?
In the little time I've had to play it lately, I've been really, really enjoying the Super Mario 3D. What is it called? 3D All Stars.
3D All Stars.
Yeah, it's been so much fun. I basically just wanted to play Bob-omb Battlefield once from Mario 64, and then ever since then I've just been playing through Sunshine with all the free time I can try and squeeze out. So it's been a lot of fun just reliving like some of my favorite games from my childhood. Like that, Super Mario 64 and Sunshine in particular were two of my favorite games growing up. So it's just been good and bad, I guess. Like in some ways, I'm finding that the controls in 64 were they're pretty frustrating to use by today's standards, but they were huge for their time. So I'm trying to appreciate that at least while I play.
That is that's a title that I'm going to need to buy, I guess, before it disappears, right? Because for some reason they're taking it off the store and. March, but
yeah, you got until March 31st, I think.
I think I'll handle it. Do you think they're gonna put it on sale before it goes away? Because I feel like it has to. Like they can't just like why would they remove it? It doesn't make any sense.
They're resurrecting the Disney Vault strategy, and as a lifelong Disney fanatic, that is not something you want to repeat. Because I'm sorry, the whole reason that the Disney Vault strategy worked was because you couldn't just download. You couldn't just buy. Because stores had turnover. We didn't have digital stores then. We have digital stores now. It makes no sense to take anything away.
Yeah, especially because now like people have been buying the physical copies of the games, just basically scooping as many copies as they can, just so that once the game basically gets discontinued in March, they can start selling it later at an upcharge. And it's like, that just sucks, you know?
Yeah, but digital, you can't do that with digital, nor should you. And be able to.
No, right. Like, I'm saying they're doing that with the physical copies.
No, I know, but I mean, like, why? Fine, get rid of the physical copies. Like, you know, make your artificial scarcity, you know, make that a collector's edition or collector's item and boost the price artificially. But like digitally, why would you remove access to a game from your digital store after a set amount of time? It really doesn't make sense. Unless there is another product down the road that they would bundle it into to replace it, maybe a subscription service that you currently have access to. I don't know. It seems like they have to evolve Nintendo Nintendo's online service, whatever it's called, to eventually include Switch games as opposed to just SNES and NES games. So maybe down the road, we'll hear about that. I don't know. I'm just speculating, but that makes sense.
I think one of the things I've seen people sort of speculate as a result of the whole, you know, game going away in March is that they might be working on like a GameCube emulator or just some kind of like, yeah, just like a bigger scope of backwards compatibility. So if that happens and it does include these games, then that's great, even though that'll kind of mean I spent $60 for nothing, I guess. But, you know, I would love to see that because most of my favorite games growing up were honestly on the GameCube, other than, like, I don't know, Halo.
Kingdom Hearts.
Is that Mario thing $60, like, to buy it?
Yeah, but, I mean, you get three games. You get 64, Sunshine, and Galaxy.
Yeah, I'm going to age myself again like I did before we hopped on this. I have never played any of those Mario games, so I was debating like picking it up, but I don't know if I want to spend $60 for something I'm not going to get like a nostalgia effect from, and if I'm just going to like get frustrated with the older control schemes and everything.
Super Mario 64 still ranks just constantly in the top 10 games of all time. It's an historic just piece. It's an art form.
I agree to some extent, but I feel like after playing Odyssey, going back and dealing with the ridiculous camera problems from 64 would just make me want to scream because the camera, from the reviews I've read, the camera issues have not been fixed.
Yeah, the camera's horrible.
That is not something I want to deal with again because I was... You know, I remember being very angry when I was a child playing that game because the camera would just get lost and you'd like be trying to perform this like perfect jump and then the camera would get stuck on a mountain and you'd just be like, where is Mario? Why can't I move right now? And it was just so infuriating.
Well, the good news is we're all very angry as adults now. So what do you have to lose?
Right, exactly. Let me blow some steam off by screaming at this terrible camera on my Super Mario game. No, I think I'll just stick with Odyssey actually, because I don't know, I don't have the same nostalgia as I guess some people do with 64. Like, bring me GoldenEye, give me a Perfect Dark or a GoldenEye remaster on Switch, I would be all for that. I spent a lot of time playing those two games, but
didn't they remaster GoldenEye for like PS4 or Xbox or something? I swear there was a remaster of that came out less than 10 years ago.
That sounds familiar.
Well, I just wanted for Switch.
Have you heard of GoldenEye, or was that
a calculator game? What was that?
Oh, dude. Although, if we really want to date, if I really want to date myself here, I never had a Nintendo 64 or a GameCube. I had a PlayStation, PlayStation 2, PlayStation 3, and a Wii.
I think I had all of those. I only skipped out on like the Xbox until the 360 or maybe the One.
And I own no gaming consoles now. I don't even have the Switch, which I feel like I'm missing out a little bit. And then I go to a theme park and I forget about all of that.
So I made the unfortunate mistake, I guess, of pre-ordering all of the consoles. So I currently have a PS5 and an Xbox Series X and a Series S pre-ordered.
Jeez.
Because I just got them because I just... I'm gonna get them and then either sell them unopened or one of them, or I'm gonna cancel them. But it was really hard to get pre-orders the day that they came out, and I'm like, I might as well just keep the pre-order because I know people in my life that will want these. I'm gonna figure out which one I want to keep. Right now, I have the Xbox One original and the PS4 Pro, so I'm thinking I'll sell the PS5. Keep the Series X with Game Pass, and then also sell the Series S to you know, somebody else. So I'm only going to end up with one because nobody needs both the new consoles on launch day. But I mean, I got the pre-orders. I might as well keep them, right?
Tell you what, I'll work a couple of weekends for the PS5.
Deal. Get a video to hit 200,000 views. And we'll talk.
Oh man,
this is your next challenge.
Okay, I can do that.
All right. Yeah. Let's take it offline. All right. My what's making me happy this week is ironically a game that I'm playing on my Mac just because I can. It's called Hades. It's a game that got released last week for Switch and on Steam, and it's compatible with PC and Mac, which is why I'm playing it on my Mac. I decided to buy it on my on Steam just because I wanted to see how well it would play on my MacBook Pro. There are so few games that are Mac compatible on day one that I was like, why not? It's a roguelike, very similar to Dead Cells, but it's sort of top-down Diablo style. It's made by Supergiant, so Bastion and Transistor, two of my favorite games ever. They're just incredible titles. You play Hades' son, who wants to get out of the underworld, and he is snarky and hilarious, and the graphics are incredible. Everything about this game is fun. Even the dying is fun. I think it's one of my favorite games I've played in the last couple of years. And as somebody who's like really looking forward to Diablo 4, even though this is not the same kind of game, just I get nostalgic for Diablo when I play this because it's the same top-down point of view and it's a fighting action game. Highly recommend it. It's not expensive. I think I paid $28 Canadian.
I've heard highly
recommend Hades.
Yeah, I've heard so many good things about that, and I just got into Dead Cells like 2 weeks ago, and I don't play a lot of roguelikes, and I got kind of irritated when I realized the whole permadeath kind of thing, but then I just got like insanely addicted to that with like the combat and how fast it moves and everything. So then I heard people comparing Dead Cells to Hades, and like, I have to buy this at some point. Like, I still have so much of Dead Cells to get through, but I would love like another game that has similar ideas, but like does them with that kind of top-down view and everything.
I mean, if you like roguelikes, I've just been constantly playing Spelunky 1 and 2 lately. And that's always, like, Spelunky 1 was my favorite game, probably of all time.
Yeah, I've heard, like, a lot of people rave about that. And now that I'm, like, understanding the genre and realize I kind of love it, like, I feel like I've got a lot of games like that to work my way through now.
All I'm going to say is I've sunk in over 200 hours over the years into Spelunky.
Holy.
So... don't recommend it, but it's a good game.
That sounds like Diablo 2 for me. I sunk so many hours into that game that I will never get back. But yeah, I don't regret it. You know, no regrets.
Yeah.
I also recommend getting Dead Cells on Android and then spending $1,400 on a Surface Duo. And then getting a Bluetooth controller and then bending the Surface Duo into laptop mode and then playing it that way. It's a great use of your money.
Or and, you just play it on Game Pass for free.
Tons of fun. Is it on Game Pass?
It is. That's how I found it and started playing it.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I don't have Game Pass yet. But
you have a much better solution, though. It's much more economic.
Yeah, totally. way more affordable. And you get a Surface Duo out of it, which, you know, makes for,
is that a pro
talking about getting angry? Like this thing is still, it still makes me so angry because it's got so much potential. Anyway, we've run really long. This did make me happy though. Talking about all these games. I love them. All right. That's it. Thank you everybody for joining us. Ara, Joe, Hayato, thank you. We are hopefully going to publish this on Thursday, so you're going to hear this a day after the event. Let us know what you thought of Google's event. It was 30 minutes from start to finish, which is the shortest virtual event that we've seen so far. Was it too short? I actually think it was. They didn't spend enough time on the products themselves. Let us know, podcast@androidcentral.com. You can find Joe at JoeMaring1 on Twitter. You can find Ara at Ara Wagco. You can find Hayato at Hayato Huseman. You can find me at Journey Dan. You can find all of us at Android Central. We will be back next week with another episode. Talk to you later.
See ya.
Yeet.
Bye.